We are talking today with Peter Nabokov. Peter Nabokov is professor of American Indian Studies and World Arts and Cultures at UCLA. He is the author of numerous articles, reports, and books, including A Forest of Time, American Indian Ways of History, Native American Testimony, A Chronicle of Indian-White Relations from Prophecy to Present, 1492 to 1992. And he's here to talk about his latest book, Where the Lightning Strikes, The Lives of American Indian Sacred Places. Peter, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
Start out, if you would, and tell us what was the motivation in writing your book, Where the Lightning Strikes?
It began a long time ago, and at times I turned around and it was as if the subject was stalking me. I did a book with an architect called Native American Architecture, and it took us 17 years, and that was on the built environment. And it was quite ambitious. We tried to cover North America, and we tried to do something above the standard treatment of teepees, wigwams, and igloos. We tried to dignify the architectural systems of North America as a window through which one could learn about the social, the historical, the aesthetic, as well as the religious life of Native peoples. And that was an apprenticeship to a complex body of data. It was a terrific experience. Robert Easton and I went from coast to coast, from the Pacific Northwest down to northern Mexico. And out of that experience came an interest in Indian cosmological systems, how they organize the world, and how their rituals and practices in the past as well as in the present reflect that organization of the world, what we call cosmology, cosmological systems. And that led to an appreciation, a greater appreciation, in the non-built environment for me, in Indian relationships with their landscapes. And I pluralize it advisedly. You know, playing in town is this film, The New World. I became interested in North America as an old world, indeed many old worlds, overlapping old worlds. And I wanted to tell the stories of some of these old worlds to give readers a sense of the diversity and complexity of Indian belief systems, Indian religious systems, particularly as they're related to the environment. And in the process of doing that, collecting material on various sites, two things happened. One is that I realized that I had lived, there was virtually no place I had ever lived in North America, and I've moved from the East Coast to the West, that did not have its shadow geography of an Indian presence. That was one thing, and I began to sort of, I found myself willy-nilly, this is not a book about me, but I found myself sort of revisiting my own biography in terms of place, and trying to excavate, you might say, the meaning systems that had existed, or in some cases still even existed without my being aware of it, that were Native American in those locations. From the East Coast to the West, the Midwest, New Mexico, and finally in California, where I live now, outside of L.A. The other thing that happened was that kind of gave an urgency to this project is towards the end of work on the book on Native American architecture, Indian issues related to sacred objects, repatriation of burial goods and the like, protection of ceremonies that were coming under government scrutiny, and the protection of sacred places became a hot political topic. And that is what inspired the American Indian Religious Freedom Act of 1978, signed by Jimmy Carter. In the wake of that act, however, there were a series of court cases which kind of toppled like dominoes, one right after another. The Tellico Dam case, the San Francisco Peaks case, Tellico Dam case in eastern Tennessee, the San Francisco Peaks case in Arizona, the Bear Butte case in South Dakota, and then finally the Go Road case in northwestern California. And for Indian people, these were a series of slaps in the face. An act that they thought had protected their sacred places on public lands, at the very least on public lands, giving them special attention, providing them with special access, suddenly seemed to be knocked asunder. And a number of journalists and writers kind of tried to bring these cases to public attention. Peter Matheson wrote a series of terrific articles and others, but it really never caught on. And Indian peoples were left with a sinking feeling that nothing had really changed, and that the American Indian Religious Freedom Act was, quote-unquote, without any teeth. And so that developed in me an urgency to tell the stories of those cases. But my goal is less, although I have been a working journalist in the past, my goal is less as a journalist here, but as a sort of cultural anthropologist writing for the general reader. And I wanted to dignify American Indian systems of belief as they relate to the wider landscape, tell stories of places so they practically became what I call biographies of place. And I use the word lives advisedly in the subtitle. I wanted to recreate the full-bodied belief systems that had existed, or in some cases exist still today, so that readers would understand that the analogies that we often use, that sacred Indian place is to them like Chartres Cathedral or like Mecca to Muslims. I wanted to kind of get away from that and think about landscapes and position these places within understandable belief systems that are concerned with relationships between human beings and the environment that are different than those of the Euro-Americans that conquered this country and that sequestered Indians on reservations, and that in some cases, in many cases, erased their religious history from the screen. And I wanted to resurrect. And I had probably 100 different examples, case studies I could have chosen. 4 were chosen for me because of these 4 court cases that conveniently, for the purposes of literary organization, allowed me to organize the book East, South, North, and West. But under each of those, you could say, sacred directions, I included 3 other case studies that gave a different flavor. And I wanted people to read this book and not think of the United States, to be honest with you. I wanted them to think of North America, and I wanted them to think of many North Americas, somehow demarcated by ecology. The desert is different from the plains, after all, and the plains different than the woodlands, and the woodlands and the interior woodlands different than the West Coast. But my interest was to conjure up multiple worlds, be they ever so small in terms of demography, you know, not a whole lot of people, but in terms of longevity of thought and religious passion and cosmological organization, very deep and complex. So I wanted to establish the pre-Christian origins of religious practice in North America and do it through the lens of the environment, environmental relations. And I wanted to get away from notions of harmony with nature, simplistic New Age characterizations of Indian beliefs, and kind of scrape away. You know, Vine Deloria Jr., the great Indian writer and activist and leader who died a few months ago and to whom this book is dedicated, told a friend of mine, Toby McLeod, who wrote and directed a wonderful film called In the Light of Reverence about American Indian sacred places. It was on PBS. It's one of their masterwork series. Told him toward the last months of his life, when Toby was talking to Vine Deloria and asking for advice about a new film related to world sacred places, Vine's advice was, go deeper. Go deeper. And I have always found in studying American Indian cultures that I never got deep enough. There was always another layer, a layer of mystery and complexity, of symbolic resonance, and I just had to always go deeper. And this book allowed me to tell 16 stories of place and go as deep as I thought the general reader could tolerate.
So would it be fair to say that, in a way, what you're looking for is, when we hear terms like holy lands applied to the Middle East, I mean, that's the image that comes up when you say holy lands.
Sure.
But to redefine that so instead, as Americans, we think of local holy lands.
Right. Then. Yeah, absolutely. Indeed, the first article I ever published was in 1980 on this subject, and it was called America as Holy Land. And I wrote it out of passion. And it had too much rhetoric in it and not enough factual complexity. As I look back on it, I'm a little chagrined by the piece, but at least it was the seed of something. And I found myself reevaluating what I knew and having to reconsider what I knew and peeling back the layers of scholarship and visits that I would end up taking, some of them targeted because I knew that a particular place had a story, some of them serendipitous where I stumbled upon a place and a story sort of just emerged and I had to follow it. And so I would say American today, America as holy lands. But even the term holy land became problematic, and I wanted to reevaluate it. It evokes a established religious geography. I also became interested in the idea of promised lands, where it's as if it's a religious geography that has been predestined, but where a new people find, settlers find themselves discovering the spirits of a place for the first time. We think about that as a Euro-American, a uniquely Euro-American historical experience, but I have found time and time again where migratory Indian peoples had that same experience. So I, in one chapter, for example, juxtaposed a subtle distinction between promised lands, which are in an act of becoming, where a people are creating their own place, which is the case of the Crow Indians of Montana, for instance, and a holy land, which has been established perhaps by greater antiquity, greater time of residence, greater complexity of thought evolving gradually in a place, greater systems of ritual, vision questing, shrine creating, pilgrimage enacting, systems that help to steep a people in a place for such a long period of time. It's as if they were always, always there. And then, of course, archaeology tells us that, no, there were earlier Indian cultures who were there as well, which is why in a place like the eastern Tennessee Tellico River region, it's such a tragedy that that's lost, because that is a veritable book of multiple American Indian civilizations learning to live in a place, being sequentially replaced by another American Indian civilization, the Cherokee only being the last of the sequence to establish residence there. So it's that kind of depth and complexity that helped me to move beyond the notion of one holy land into multiple holy lands, into promised lands, into the interesting contrast between migratory peoples coming into a new territory and peoples of long residence in a territory, small demography in some cases, small populations, larger in others. What are the subtle differences? I wanted to dignify Native America as being a complex mosaic of cultures over a long period of time, with philosophical systems that we still have yet to understand, much less respect.
And in your book, you challenge a bunch of myths, one of them being the simple viewpoint that people will say, well, Native Americans believe this or that.
Right. Yeah, it's this business that comes under the anthropological, the name of the anthropological crime called essentialism, where one boils down cultures to a couple precepts, which oftentimes are either romantic projections or racist projections, but are sometimes equally misguided and full of misrepresentation. I wanted to shy away from that in talking about the diversity of Indian Native American approaches, tribal approaches, different societal approaches to landscape.
And the other myths that you challenge in your book was that sacred places would necessarily be these visually stunning kind of coffee table book places.
Right. Yeah, in doing the book and actually constructing it, there was slight pressure from friends or queries and strong queries from the publisher, which I had to address, about, great, we're going to get a chance to see these places. Which photographers do you think might supply images? And there are some wonderful books on American Indian sacred places. Don't get me wrong. I just felt that a couple things. I felt not all of them that I was interested in were pretty to look at. Not all of them that I was interested Indians wanted portrayed. And I also felt that the reader, the contemporary reader, viewer of books, is so conditioned to a superficial consumption of visual images, be they ever so expertly contrived, that they would not pay attention to what I was after. And what I was after were the systems of thought and meaning that gave these places profound resonance. I thought that they would treat my words as if they were extended captions, where you simply go for the name of the place, what state is it in, and where's the map about how I can get there. Most of my places are places I don't think people ought to visit. As a matter of fact, some of them Indians don't want people to visit. And some of the controversies I talk about are exactly about that issue, whether it be skiing on the San Francisco peaks or rock climbers climbing Devil's Tower. These are the controversies, places where Indian people feel outsiders might desecrate by making too much noise or by driving metal into the crevices of rocks, and thereby injure the lives, the sensate properties of these places. You know, in many cases, these rocks and trees and mountains that I'm talking about are not inanimate. These are animate. These are beings. These are beings with volition and with intentionality. These are persons with whom Native traditions have tried to interact and transact and provide offerings so that there can be some sort of equitable relationship between human beings and places and the benefits of those places, whether it be in the form of rain or animals to be delivered finally to the dinner table or whatever, are determined by your relationships with those places. And these systems of reciprocity that Indian peoples in many cases developed, and I try to characterize and describe the differences of those, are sacrosanct and should not be, my feeling is, meddled with. And so I wanted to avoid photographs, avoid easy, consumable images. I wanted to have readers explore the complexity without making it arduous for them. I tried to make these chapters, you know, palatable. They're stories, after all. I'm a storyteller. And so I tried to tell the stories, the biographies of these places.
You said the 1978...
American Indian Religious Freedom Act, you're right.
Was a turning point, but it sounded like, in a way, it was just a hollow passage.
Well, for public lands, it did not achieve its original intent. There were things that it definitely did. It lightened up the pressure on members of the Native American Church, who use the hallucinogenic cactus Lophophora williamsi, peyote, as its sacramental food. It lightened up the pressure on them. It gave special dispensation for Indians to utilize the feathers from endangered species, birds particularly, for feathers and fans associated with worship. It protected Indian rights to repatriation of burial goods. Museums across the United States had to sort of stand up to the plate, reinventory their materials, see if there were religious materials, notify tribes of that. It set a climate that allowed, for example, ethnographic reports of public lands, national parks. It established funding for those reports. I even participated in one and did a book about Yellowstone National Park with an archaeologist named Lawrence Lowendorf about the American Indian associations with Yellowstone. Prior to that, people were primarily interested in archaeological resources, the remains left in the ground. But what we were engaged to investigate were the ethnographic resources, the memories of living people about a place. And whereas the park, for example, Yellowstone Park, had to somewhat denied the association between its domain and Indians ever since its establishment in 1871, we investigated and found half a dozen tribes who had associations. We verified that through painstakingly teased out evidence, some from the tribes themselves and some from archives. And as recently as 3 weeks ago in the Congressional Record, it was written in that the Kootenai Salish have historical ties to Fishing Bridge, for example, right in the heart of the park. So the American Indian Religious Freedom Act and associated legislation at the time, the NAGPRA legislation related to grave goods and burials, has had an effect and did help to change the climate. But one of the most difficult and intransigent issues had to do with the protection of sacred lands on public lands. The multiple-use policy, the division of church and state, made it very difficult for Indians to acquire exclusive rights to particular park areas, whether it be Mount Shasta or whether it be Devil's Tower, or whether it be portions of the Black Hills, etc., exclusive right to those places, even for short periods of time. So they lost Devil's Tower case, for example. And now the rangers at Devil's Tower simply plead with people, don't climb during the month of June, because that's when Indians want to conduct various ceremonies. They want to have it be a time of meditation. Or, as Vine Deloria says, these places need time of their own to recuperate. These places need time of their own in peace. And that's where my idea of the lives of sacred places kind of gains its resonance and its evocation, because I agree with him. There is something about these places that have been dignified and hallowed for a long period of time that should make us mere humans stand back and leave them alone for a little while.
So in a way, this book is giving voice to those sacred places.
I'd like to think so. In a minor way, I'd like to think so.
Are there any examples in other countries, other cultures, where they have protected sacred places?
I've just come from India, from a month in South India. I'm collaborating with a South Indian guy on the life of a river. It's 15 years now. Getting to know this particular stream, it's not a great sacred river, only runs for 250 kilometers from the headwaters in the Western Ghats to its mouth in the Bay of Bengal, Polk Straits. And along the way, we're doing everything, talking to all kinds of people, collecting the histories of temples along the river, looking at the multiple religious sites along the river, from Hindu to Islamic to Christian, for that matter. And in the process, I encountered the institution of the sacred grove, which is now protected by the government of the state of Tamil Nadu, but it's actually ubiquitous throughout India. And these are locations that are protected because of a revelatory experience that somebody had there. A tree was a site where somebody had a vision of the goddess, and that tree then becomes a place of minor pilgrimage, and that increases as more experiences, religious experiences, are enhanced at that place and testimonies develop, and the regions are then demarcated. They can be as small as 2 acres, as large as 200 acres or larger, and they become bioregions as well, regions for protection of various species. You can have of plants and animals, and you can have the border of those places. I've been to some in which you'll see monoculture right on the other side of the fence. It'll be bananas, or it'll be pecans, or whatever. But inside, it's a multiplicity of plants. It's very quiet. Bird sanctuary, naturally, although not designed to be a bird sanctuary. These are sacred groves, like the sacred groves of ancient Greece. And there's a wonderful poem by W.H. Auden, which he actually dedicated to my father, who was a composer. And at some point in the poem, at the end of the poem, he says, "A culture is only as good as its woods." And it's about the care of the forest. And it's about the relationship between the built and the non-built environment. And it's about how a culture's soul, you might say, is directly proportionate to the degree to which it looks after its wider environment.
Well, going with that, what would be your assessment of our current culture here in the U.S.?
Well, I don't position myself as some grand analyst or prognosticator. I read the same newspapers you read and receive the same warnings over the television. I know the climate is going through changes, dramatic changes. I've just been to the Southwest where there's this incredible dry spell. I feel the tumult of our times politically as well as environmentally. There is a dangerous shift in the wind, shifts in the wind literally and figuratively. And I think there's a loss of direction on all kinds of fronts, and not the least of them is on the environmental front. This book is, however, not a plea for sort of self-protective environmentalism. And indeed, the sacred places that I'm talking about in this book have a sort of edgy relationship with the environmental movement, which has only stepped in to back the Indian causes at very periodic intervals. They didn't help with Rainbow Bridge and protecting Navajo access to that site, and the Navajo arguments for it. They didn't really step in when it came to protecting Indian rights to Devil's Tower. They've shied away, with the exception of Mount Graham and a couple of others, from most of the disputes that I've been talking about. So I'm leery of answering your question. It would be for another program and another book.
All right. Well, we unfortunately only have a few minutes left. What final thoughts would you like to leave with our listeners?
I'd like them to explore the shadow geographies of Indian history and culture in their own region. I'd like people to interact more with Indian communities, those people who are non-Indians. I'd like more awareness of the issues that Indians say are important. I'd like less distractions like discussion over Indian casinos and more attention to the durable issues of the histories that all Americans share with Indian people. I'd like to have the Indian presence in North America dignified in the schools at all levels. And I'd like to have Indians finding more allies in their fights for sacred lands among the wider population.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
We have just been talking with Peter Nabokov. He is author of the new book, Where the Lightning Strikes, The Lives of American Indian Sacred Places.